Hello and welcome to an especially soggy edition of the Cory Doctorow podcast. We are just catching the first wave of two atmospheric rivers, Pineapple Expresses, that are going to drown us here in Southern California this weekend and week. This is when a gigantic amount of water is picked up from over Hawaii and dumped on Southern California. We used to get these once every several years. Now we get several of them in a row every year. And boy, oh boy, we did a lot of work on our drains last year to try and prevent the flooding that we've had over and over again. And I'm sitting here with my fingers crossed that it's all going to work because this is the acid test. So I'm gearing up to go out on tour with The Bezel, the second Martin Hench novel. I'll mention that you can read that novel on its own without having read Red Team Blues, the first book in the series. They're designed to stand alone. But if you wanted to read Red Team Blues before reading The Bezel, I wouldn't tell you you were wrong to do it. The book comes out on the 20th of February, and I'm going to be all over the place. Only four of those dates are now like firm and announced with actual bookstores and URLs. So that's Weller Bookworks in Salt Lake City on February the 21st, Third Place Books in Seattle on February the 26th, the Tucson Festival of Books on March 9th and 10th, and as part of my keynote for the Media Ecology Association in Amherst, New York on June 6th through 9th. But I will also be in San Francisco and San Diego, Los Angeles, Silicon Valley, Marin, Seattle, Portland, Oregon, Vancouver, Calgary, Phoenix, Chicago, Toronto, New York City, Providence, Boston, Anaheim, Turin, Italy, and Tartu, Estonia. So lots of stuff coming up, lots of travel. And I will see you on the road, I hope. Watch this space for more details. And as always, if you go to pluralistic.net, there is an upcoming appearances section with all the latest. So any day, just go and check that out. It is the observed birthday of my daughter, Posey Taylor Doctorow, as I record this on Sunday, the 4th of February. Her birthday is the 3rd. She turned 16 yesterday. It was a big deal. But she also had her very first dance competition. And so my parents came into town for that. We still got them in the house. We drove all the way down to Anaheim to watch her perform. She and her team did amazing. It's a hectic time. My parents got into town last week on Thursday, the same day I got back from Berlin after quite a hectic journey home. The Berlin airport that I had been meant to fly out of on Thursday morning shut down, as did every other airport in Germany except the ones in Bavaria, due to a strike. And so at the last minute, I discovered that the strike was coming the next day. I spent very long hours on a train from Berlin to Munich, got in very late, got up very early, and managed to get home in time for my parents and my daughter's birthday. While I was in Berlin, I did a number of things, a lot of press and a couple of events at Otherland Bookstore. But the main event was that I gave the annual Marshall McLuhan lecture at the Canadian Embassy on the subject of enshittification. And it was a very successful lecture. The house was packed. I subsequently published the transcript. There'll be a link to that in the show notes. It's gone around, and there's a major business weekly that's going to be publishing it in its weekend magazine. And I thought I would include it here for you, especially since it looks like I am about to contract to write a book based on the outline of this talk. And so there are three publishers currently bidding on that, and I will have more news when I have more news. But it's a very exciting development. Anyway, I'm not going to natter on much longer. I have the rip of the talk from YouTube. I pulled that out of the Canadian Embassy's YouTube channel. I just wanted to say that in this era in which stream ripping is becoming once again a very controversial issue, and we're hearing people say that it is against the interests of creative workers to allow people to download from YouTube, that it's also in the interests of creative workers to be able to download from YouTube. Here I am, a creative worker, downloading my own performance from YouTube, something that I wouldn't be able to do without these stream ripping tools. And so remember that when, as you hear this increasingly heated rhetoric condemning stream ripping technology, that for artists who want to take their work away from intermediaries, stream ripping is absolutely crucial. Anyway, without any more natter, here is my McLuhan lecture on enshittification, recorded last week in Berlin at the Canadian Embassy for the Transmediale Festival.
Bonsoir, messieurs, Mr. Ambassador, hello, good evening. I have to say, hearing Herr Professor Dr. Doctorow, that was my dream come true. I actually went to Innes College at the University of Toronto and dropped out. I went to the University of Waterloo, where I studied under Harold Innes's daughter and Innes Dagg, and dropped out. I also dropped out of York University and Michigan State. I never got an undergraduate degree, but now I hold two doctorates. And the only reason I wanted them is someone once told me that once you have two doctorates, the Germans will call you Dr. Doctor. So here we are. Dream come true. All right. So last year, I coined this term in shitification to describe the way that platforms decay, and my obscene little word is doing big numbers. The American Dialectic Society made it the word of the year, which I presume means that I am now destined to have a poop emoji on my tombstone. So what is enshittification, and why did it catch fire? Enshittification is my theory explaining how the internet was colonized by platforms, and why all those platforms are all degrading so quickly and so thoroughly right now, and why that matters, and what we can do about it. So we are living through an era we can call the enshittocene, a great enshittening in which all the services that matter to us, that we rely on, are turning into giant piles of shit all at once. This is frustrating, it's demoralizing, it's even terrifying, and I think the mind shittification framework goes a long way to explaining it. It moves us out of the realm of quasi-mystic notions of the great forces of history and into a material world of specific decisions made by named people, decisions that we can reverse, made by people whose addresses and pitchfork sizes we can discover. Enshittification names the problem and proposes a solution. It's not just a way of saying things are getting worse. So, of course, it's fine with me if that's how you want to use it. It's an English word, and in English, we don't have der Rat für English Rechtschreibung. English is a free-for-all. Our words mean whatever you want them to mean. So go nuts, mein Kerle. So in case you want to use enshittification in a more precise and technical way, I'm going to examine tonight how enshittification works. This is a three-stage process. First, platforms are good to their users. Then they abuse their users to allocate value to their business customers. Finally, they abuse those business customers to reallocate value to themselves, and then they die. So let's do a case study, and there is no better case study for enshittification than Facebook. Facebook is a company that was literally founded to non-consensually rate the fuckability of Harvard undergraduates, and it got worse after that. When Facebook started, it was only open to US college kids. You needed a .edu address. But in 2006, all that changed. They opened up to the general public. And it told all of those users out there, hey, I know you're using MySpace, but MySpace is owned by Rupert Murdoch. And he's an evil, crapulent, senescent Australian billionaire who spies on you with every hour that God sends. Come to Facebook. We're the service that will never spy on you. All you need to do is tell us who matters to you in this world, and we will compose a dynamic real-time feed of everything those people post for the people who follow them and that they want them to see. That was stage one. Facebook had this surplus, this cash from its investors, and it allocated the surplus to those end users. The end users then locked themselves into Facebook. Facebook, like most tech businesses, enjoys something that economists call network effects. Products and services enjoy network effects if they get better when more people use them. So you joined Facebook because there were some people there that you wanted to talk to, and then they joined Facebook because they wanted to talk to you. But Facebook didn't just have great network effects. It had massive switching costs. Switching costs, another economist term, is everything you have to give up when you change products or services. And in Facebook's case, the switching cost were all the friends that followed you onto Facebook and that you followed onto Facebook. Now, in theory, all of you could have just decided to leave Facebook together and go somewhere else. But in practice, you were hamstrung by another economist term, the collective action problem. It's hard to get a lot of people to do the same thing at the same time. If you came here with half a dozen friends and you go out for drinks when it's over, you're going to argue for a long time about where to go for drinks. You have no hope of getting 200 Facebook friends to all leave Facebook, let alone agree on where you're going to go. So Facebook users engaged in this form of mutual hostage taking that kept them glued to the platform. And Facebook understood and exploited that hostage situation and began to withdraw surplus from its end users and allocated to two different groups of business customers, advertisers and publishers. So to the advertisers, Facebook said, do you remember when we told these credulous losers that we weren't gonna spy on them? That was a lie. We are spying on them from asshole to appetite, and for very small amounts of money, we will sell you access to that surveillance data. Just tell us who you wanna show an ad to, and we will show the ad to that person. We have an entire building full of engineers who are gonna do nothing but fight ad fraud. Every dollar you spend is gonna buy you an ad that's gonna be seen by the person you intended to see it. Then Facebook turned to the publishers and it said, hey, do you remember when we told these hayseeds that we were only gonna show them the things that they asked to see? That was also a lie. All you need to do is upload excerpts of the content from your website to Facebook with a link back to your website, and we will non-consensually cram that into the eyeballs of people who never asked to see it. We will give you a free traffic funnel of people who will come to your website that you can monetize as you see fit. And so the users will become stuck to your feed, and they'll become your subscribers, and they'll see everything you post after that. And so advertisers and publishers, they got stuck to the platform too, held hostage by the users who are holding each other hostage. And everyone was locked in. And that was a signal for Facebook to start withdrawing that surplus and handing it over to its own shareholders. So for the users, this meant that the experience of being on Facebook changed. The stuff in your feed was no longer the things that you'd asked to see. That was dialed down to a homeopathic dose, which left behind an enormous amount of space that Facebook could fill up with paid-for-boost content and advertisements. For the advertisers, it meant that the prices went up even as enforcement of against ad fraud went down, so advertisers paid much more to reach fewer people, and the people that they reached were worse, were not targeted as finely and as accurately. For publishers, Facebook took its algorithmic feed and it turned down the likelihood that its content would be suggested or shown to its subscribers unless they put more and more of each article in the feed. Until finally, they were posting full texts to Facebook, the whole article, turning them into a commodity back-end supplier to Facebook. And then for the coup de grace, Facebook said, when you put a link back to your website in your feed, we don't know if it's a malicious link. And so if you want your stuff to reach the people who asked to see it, you can't link back to your own website. You are trapped here monetizing your work through our increasingly crooked and corrupted advertising marketplace. When those groups squawked, the publishers, the advertisers, Facebook executives repeated the lesson that they had perfected when they all took the Darth Vader MBA. That lesson is, I have altered the deal. Pray I don't alter it further. Facebook now enters the most dangerous phase of shitification, the point at which it has drawn out all of the available surplus, leaving behind just enough residue that everyone stays locked to the platform. Business customers stuck to end users, end users stuck to each other. But that is a very, very brittle equilibrium, because the difference between, God, I hate this place, but I can't seem to stop logging into it, and what the hell am I still doing here? I'm bolting for the exits, is razor thin. It just takes one Cambridge Analytica scandal, one whistleblower, one live stream mass shooting, and people bolt for the exit. And then Facebook discovers that network effects are a two-edged sword. Because if you can't leave because everyone else is staying, then once everyone else starts to leave, there's no reason for you not to go too. And that is terminal shitification, the phase where the platform becomes a giant pile of shit. And that phase triggers something that you and I would call panic. But in Silicon Valley, they have a technical term for it. They call it pivoting. And Facebook's pivot was, we've changed our mind. The future isn't arguing with your racist uncle in a text forum. It's me converting all of you to legless, sexless, heavily surveilled, low-polygon cartoon characters in a virtual world called the Metaverse that we stole from a 25-year-old cyberpunk novel. Now, that is the process of enshittification. If enshittification were a disease, we call it the disease's natural history. But it doesn't tell you how the enshittification works, nor does it tell you why everything is enshittifying right now. And without those details, we can't know what to do about enshittification. So let's talk about what led to the enshittocene. What is it about this moment that led to the great enshittening? Was it the end of the zero interest rate policy? Was it a change in the leaders at those tech giants? Did Mercury go into retrograde? I think it's none of the above. First of all, the period of free money certainly led to tech companies having a lot of surplus to toss around, but Facebook started its incentivization journey long before the zero interest rate policy ended, and so did Amazon, Microsoft, and Google. And while it's true that some of those big tech companies have had high-profile changes in leadership, Google's incentivization actually got worse when its founders came back to oversee its AI panic, which of course they call its AI pivot. And it cannot be Mercury in retrograde, because I'm a Cancer. And as everybody knows, Cancers don't believe in astrology. When a whole bunch of independent entities all start to change in the same way at the same time, that is a sign that the environment that they operate in has changed. And that's what happens in tech. Tech companies, like every kind of company, have conflicting imperatives. On the one hand, they want to make money. On the other, making money involves hiring people and motivating them, and also making products that people want to buy. And the more value a company permits its employees and customers to carve off, the less value it has to give to its shareholders. The equilibrium in which companies produce things that we like in an honorable way, at a fair price, is one in which charging more, or worsening quality, or harming workers, costs more than the company would make by cheating. Now, there are four forces that discipline companies and prevent them from cheating. They serve as constraints on the incentivatory impulses of their executive teams. The first force is competition. Companies that fear that you are going to take your business elsewhere are cautious about worsening quality and raising prices. The second force is regulation. Companies that fear that a regulator will fine them more than they stand to make from cheating are less likely to cheat. Those two forces affect all industries, of course, but the other two forces are tech-specific, and they act on the tech companies in particular. So the third force is self-help. Computers are extremely flexible, and so are the digital products and services that we build out of them, because the only computer that we know how to make, the only computer that computer science can build for you, is the Turing-complete universal von Neumann machine. The computer that can run every program that we know how to write. Every valid program can run on every computer. And that means that a user can always hypothetically avail themselves of a program to undo the anti-features that a company has introduced in order to incentivize its products. Think here of a hypothetical. You're at a boardroom table, and someone says, hey, I've calculated that if we make our ads 20% more obnoxious, we can raise our revenue by 2%. In a digital world, someone else at that table might say, yes, but if we do that, 20% of our users are going to install an ad blocker. And then our expected revenue from those users, it doesn't stay static, it doesn't go up by 2%, it drops to zero forever. We never make another dime from those users. And that means that digital companies are always constrained by the fear that their incentivatory impulses will trigger a counter impulse in the user to Google, how do I disincentivize this? Now, the fourth factor that weighs on tech is workers. Tech workers do have a very low union density, but that doesn't mean that tech workers don't have worker power. The historic talent shortage in the tech sector means that workers have historically enjoyed a lot of leverage over their employers. Workers who disagreed with their bosses could always quit and walk across the street and get a better job somewhere else. And they knew it, and their bosses knew it. Now, ironically, this made tech workers more exploitable in certain ways. Tech workers overwhelmingly viewed themselves as founders in waiting, entrepreneurs temporarily drawing a salary, heroic figures of the tech mission, which is why that nonsense that we got from the big tech companies, Google saying don't be evil, Facebook saying make the world more open and connected, mattered, because they instilled a sense of mission in those workers. The librarian theorist Fobazi Attar, she calls this vocational awe, but you might know it by the more vulgar term that Elon Musk uses, being extremely hardcore. Tech workers had a lot of bargaining power, but they never flexed it when their bosses demanded that they sacrifice their health, their families, or their sleep to meet some arbitrary deadline. So long as the bosses were transforming their workplaces into whimsical campuses with gyms and gourmet cafeterias and laundry services and massages and egg freezing, workers could tell themselves that they were being pampered rather than being made to work like government mules. For bosses, there is a downside to motivating your workers by appealing to their sense of mission, namely, that they will feel a sense of mission. So when you ask them to enshittify the products that they ruin their health to ship, workers will experience a feeling of profound moral injury and respond with outrage, refuse to do it, and threaten to quit. So the tech workers themselves were the final bulwark against enshittification. Now, the pre-enshittification era was not a time of better leadership. The leaders weren't better, they were more constrained. Their worst impulses were checked by competition, regulation, self-help, and worker power. So what happened? Well, one by one, every one of those constraints was eroded until it dissolved, leaving that enshittificatory impulse unchecked, ushering in the enshittocene. It starts with competition. From Gilded Age into the Reagan years, the purpose of competition law was to promote competition. U.S. antitrust law treated corporate power as dangerous per se and sought to blunt it. European antitrust laws were modeled on those U.S. laws as technocrats from the U.S. came over during the Marshall Plan years and rewrote European competition law to be in line with American competition law. But starting in the neoliberal era, competition authorities all over the world adopted a doctrine that they called consumer welfare. Consumer welfare holds that monopolies are evidence of quality. If everyone's shopping at the same store and buying the same thing, that means that that's the best store selling the best thing, not that there's anyone cheating. And so all over the world, governments stopped enforcing their competition laws. They just ignored them as companies flouted them. The companies merged with their major competitors. They absorbed small companies before they could grow to become big threats. An orgy of consolidation that produced the most inbred industries imaginable. Whole sectors grown so incestuous that they developed Habsburg jaws. From eyeglasses to sea freight, from glass bottles to payment processing, from vitamin C to beer, most of our global economy is dominated by industries that are themselves dominated by four or five companies. If smaller companies refuse to sell to these cartels, the giants have free rein to flout competition law again with predatory pricing that keeps independent rivals from gaining footholds. When diapers.com, for example, refused to sell itself to Amazon, Amazon lit $100 million on fire, selling diapers well below cost until diapers.com collapsed. Amazon bought it for pennies on the dollar and shut it down. Competition is a distant memory. As Tom Eastman says, the web has turned into five giant websites filled with screenshots of text from the other four. So these giant companies, they no longer fear losing our business. They're not disciplined by competition. Lily Tomlin, the actor, used to do this great bit on a show called Laugh-In, where she would play a telephone operator for AT&T doing commercials for the Bell system. And every one of them would end the same way. We don't care. We don't have to. We're the phone company. Today's giants are not constrained by competition. They don't care. They don't have to. They're Google. So that's the first constraint gone. And as it slipped away, that second constraint, regulation, was also doomed. Because when an industry consists of hundreds of small companies, they are a mob. They're a rabble. They can't even agree on how to cater a meeting where they would all get together and decide on a single message to tell Parliament or the Commission or Congress. But when a sector dwindles to four or five or three or two companies, it ceases to be a mob and it becomes a cartel. Five companies or four or three or two or one find it very easy to converge on a single message for their regulators. And without the wasteful competition eroding their profits, they have a lot of money to spend on mobilizing that message to the people who are supposed to be their watchdogs. Think of Facebook handing out millions every year to the former British Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg to sleaze around Europe, glad-handing his former colleagues, telling him that Facebook is the only thing protecting European cyberspace from the Chinese Communist Party. Tech's regulatory capture allows it to flout the rules that constrain the less concentrated sectors. Tech can pretend that violating labor, consumer, and privacy law is fine because they're doing it with an app. This is why competition matters. It's not just because competition makes companies work harder and share value with their customers and workers. It's because competition keeps companies from becoming too big to fail and too big to jail. There's plenty of things that we don't want to use competition to make better. Think about the race to invade your privacy. After Europe passed the GDPR, the landmark privacy law, there was this mass extinction event for European ad tech companies. Those companies disappeared en masse, and frankly, that's fine, because those companies were even more reckless and more invasive than the American big tech companies, because they had so much less to lose. We don't want competition to see which ad tech company can be best at invading your privacy. We don't want to produce increasing efficiencies in violating your human rights. But still, Google and Facebook, who pretend that they're called Alphabet and Meta, have been unscathed by European privacy law. And that's not because they don't violate the GDPR. They violate the GDPR. It's because they pretend that they're headquartered in Ireland, one of the European Union's most notorious crime havens. And Ireland competes with other European crime havens, like Malta, Luxembourg, Cyprus, sometimes the Netherlands, to see which country can offer the most hospitable environment for corporate criminals. Because any company that can fly a flag of convenience to avoid paying tax can fly someone else's flag of convenience if their host country decides to start enforcing other laws. Which is how you get the situation we have now, where the Irish Data Protection Commissioner processes fewer than 20 major cases per year, despite being headquarters to all the major tech companies in Europe, where the German Data Commissioner is hearing more than 500 major cases every year. So Google and Facebook get to act as though they are immune to privacy law because they violate the law with an app. Just like Uber can violate labor law and claim that it doesn't count because they're doing it with an app. Uber's labor pricing algorithm offers different drivers different amounts to drive the same route depending on how choosy they have been. This is something Vina Dubal calls algorithmic wage discrimination. If you're more selective about which jobs you're willing to drive, Uber will pay you more to drive them. But if you become seduced by those higher payments and start to drive more, Uber will slowly dial down the amount that you're getting paid for every ride. Uber incrementally reduces the payment, toggling up and down as you grow more and less selective, playing you like a fish on the end of a line until inevitably you lose to the tireless pricing robot and end up stuck with low wages and all your side hustles that you were using to earn your living before when you were only driving for Uber sometimes gone. Think of Amazon. Amazon violates customer protection laws, but it says it doesn't matter because they do it with an app. Amazon makes $38 billion per year from an advertising business, but it's advertising in inverted commas because they don't sell ads with their advertising business. What they sell is placement in search results. Companies that spend the most money go to the top of the search results, even if they're offering worse products at higher prices. If you click the first link on an Amazon search result page, on average, you pay a 29% premium relative to the best product and price on Amazon. If you click one of the first four items, on average, you pay 25% premium. On average, to get the best deal on Amazon, you have to go 17 items down before you find the best deal that's there. Now, if you were to walk into any high street merchant and they played this game with you, we would fine them into oblivion. They'd be out of business. But Amazon captured its regulators, and so it can violate your rights and say, it doesn't matter, we did it with an app. This is where that third constraint, self-help, would really come in handy. You don't want your privacy violated? You don't have to wait for Google and Facebook to be disciplined. You could just install an ad blocker. More than half of all web users have installed ad blockers. But the web, it's an open platform, developed in an age in which tech companies were numbered in the hundreds, they were a rabble, and they couldn't control their regulators. Today, the web is being devoured by apps, and apps are ripe for enshittification. Because regulatory capture, after all, is not just the right to ignore regulation, it's also the ability to mobilize regulation to attack your competitors. Today's tech giants got big by exploiting self-help measures. They loved self-help measures when it was them doing it. When Facebook was telling MySpace users, hey, quit the platform owned by the evil Australian billionaire and come hang out on the privacy-respecting alternative here at Facebook. They didn't expect those users to show up at Facebook and just hang out rereading the great privacy policy while they waited for their friends to wise up and come over. Facebook gave those old MySpace users a bot, and you gave that bot your MySpace password and username, and several times a day, it went to MySpace, grabbed all the messages waiting for you, came back to Facebook, put them in your inbox, you replied to them and pushed them back out to MySpace. So you could leave MySpace and still be friends with your MySpace friends. When Microsoft was killing Apple by choking off its market oxygen, refusing to ship a functional version of Microsoft Office for the Mac, so offices were throwing away their designers' Macintoshes and buying a PC, putting a big graphics card, and getting Windows versions of the Adobe products for them, Steve Jobs did not go to Bill Gates and beg him to make a better version of Office for the Mac. He just got his technologists to reverse engineer Microsoft Office, and they made the iWork suite, which has these three apps, Pages, Numbers, and Keynote, that perfectly interoperate with all the applications in Microsoft Office, Word, PowerPoint, and Excel. When Google entered the market, it sent a crawler to every web server on the internet, presenting itself as a web user. Hi, hello, web server. I'm just a web user. Do you have any web pages? Do you have any more web pages? How about some more web pages? Every pirate wants to be an admiral. When Facebook, Apple, and Google were doing this adversarial interoperability to the giants that had come before them, that was progress. If you try to do it to them, that's piracy. If you try to make an alternative client for Facebook, they'll say you violated US laws like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and European laws like Article 6 of the European Copyright Directive. If you try to make an Android program that will run iPhone apps and play back the media you bought from Apple and its app stores, they will bomb you until the rubble bounces. If you try to scrape all of Google the way Google scraped all the web, they will nuke you till you glow. Text regulatory capture is mind-boggling. Take the law I mentioned earlier, Section 1201 of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or DMCA, signed into law by Bill Clinton in 1998, imported to Europe in 2001 as Article 6 of the European Copyright Directive. This law is a blanket prohibition on removing any kind of encryption that restricts access to a copyrighted work. Now, historically, that's meant things like ripping a DVD or jailbreaking a phone, and there are penalties of a 5-year prison sentence and a $500,000 fine for a first offense in US law. Now, this law was bad when it was passed, but in the years since, it has been so broadened by tech giants that it can be used to literally throw creators in jail for helping people access their own works. Here's how that works. In 2008, in an anti-competitive acquisition, Amazon bought a company called Audible, which was then the leading audiobooks company in the world. Today, Audible is a monopoly with more than 90% market share of the world's audiobook market. Audible requires that every book sold on their platform be encrypted with Amazon's digital rights management so that it can only be played in apps that Amazon controls. So say I write a book, I write a lot of books, and then I read it into a microphone. And then I pay an engineer thousands of dollars to master it. And then I sell it to you on Android, on Audible, rather. And then I decide that I'm not getting a very good deal from Amazon, and I'm going to start selling somewhere else. And I want to give you a tool so that you can move the book I sold you to another platform, another app. The act of providing that tool is a jailable felony, punishable by a 5-year prison sentence and a $500,000 fine. For a first offense. That's a stiffer penalty than you would pay if you were to go to a torrent site and just pirate that audiobook. But it's also a stiffer penalty than you would pay if you were to go into a truck stop and shoplift the audiobook on CD. It's probably a stiffer penalty than you would pay if you put a gun in the face of the guy who drove the truck that delivered the CDs and stole his truck. So think of our ad blockers again. Half of all web users are running ad blockers. Most of us use apps, though, and there are zero app users who are running an ad blocker, because to make an ad blocker for an app, the first thing you have to do is remove the encryption from it to decompile it, and that's a felony. Jay Freeman calls it felony contempt of business model. So when someone in a boardroom says, let's make our ads 20% more obnoxious and increase our revenue by 2%, no one says, well, if we do that, our users will try and block the ads. Instead, they say, let's make it 100% more obnoxious and get a 10% lift. Because if you go to Google and type, how do I block ads in my app, you'll get the answer, you can't. This is why every company in the world wants you to stop using their website and start using their apps. Now, there's no reason that gig workers who are facing algorithmic wage discrimination couldn't install a counter app that allowed them to coordinate among themselves to reject all drives that fall below a certain wage threshold. No reason except for that felony contempt of business model. The threat that the toolsmiths who built that tool for them could go broke or land in prison or both for violating Section 1201 of the Digital Money and Copyright Act, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, trademark, copyright, patent, contract, trade secrecy, non-disclosure, or non-compete, the whole ball of wax that we call IP law. In this context, IP is just a euphemism for any law that I can mobilize to allow me to exert control beyond the four walls of my business and control how my competitors, my critics, and my customers comport themselves. An app is just a euphemism for any web page wrapped in enough of that IP that you can go to jail for installing an ad blocker on it. We don't care. We don't have to. We're the phone company. So what about that fourth constraint? What about workers? For decades, tech workers' high degrees of bargaining power and vocational awe put a ceiling on enshittification. Even after the tech sector shrank to a handful of giants, even after they captured their regulators so that they could violate our law, our rights with impunity, even after they created felony contempt of business model and extinguished self-help for tech users, they were still constrained by those workers' sense of vocational awe and the moral injury they felt in the face of enshittification. Now, you may remember that at one point, tech workers dreamed of working for a big dumb company for 2 or 3 years before striking out on their own and founding a company that knocked over that old company and outcompeted it. But that dream shrank, and it became, go work for a big dumb tech company for 3 years, then do a pretend startup that gets acqui-hired by the company you used to work for as the most inefficient, bizarre way to get a promotion and a bonus you can imagine. But that dream shrank even further. Go work for a big company, get a job for life, they'll give you free kombucha, and every Wednesday you get a massage. Then that dream shrunk even further. It's over now. All that's left is work for the tech company until they fire your ass. Like last year when 12,000 Googlers were fired just months after the company did a stock buyback that would have paid their wages for the next 27 years. Workers are no longer a check on their boss's worst impulses. Today, the response to, I refuse to make this product worse, is turn in your badge and don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. Okay, this is a little depressing. It's a lot depressing. But hear me out. We have identified the disease. We have traced its natural history. We've identified its underlying mechanism of action. So now it's time to work on a cure. There are four constraints that prevent enshittification. There's competition, regulation, self-help, and labor. To reverse enshittification and guard against its reemergence, we have to restore and strengthen each of those. On the front of competition, it's actually looking pretty good. In the EU, in the UK, the US, Canada, Australia, Japan, and China, they're all doing more on competition than they have in two generations. They're blocking mergers. They're unwinding existing mergers. They're taking action on predatory pricing and other sleazy tactics. Remember, in the US and Europe at least, we have good competition law in the books. We just haven't been enforcing it. So all we need is a change in enforcement regimes, not any new law. Now, the enshittifiers are not taking this lying down. The business press can't stop talking about how stupid and old-fashioned all this stuff is. They call people like me hipster antitrust. And they hate any regulator who does their job. Like Lena Khan, the brilliant once-in-a-generation head of the US Federal Trade Commission, who's done more on antitrust law in 3 years than all of her predecessors combined in the last 40. Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal has run 80 editorials smearing Lena Khan, insisting that she is an ineffectual ideologue who can't get anything done. Sure, Rupert, that's why you wrote 80 editorials about her, because she can't get anything done. Even Canada, is stepping up on competition. Canada, home of the evil billionaire, from Ted Rogers, who owns all of our telecommunications, to Galen Weston, who owns all of our grocery stores, to the Irving family, who own the entire province of New Brunswick. Even Canada is doing something about this. Last autumn, Trudeau's government announced that finally, decades after every civilized land on Earth had finally done this, Canada was going to get an abusive dominance standard in its competition law. I mean, wow. I guess when Galen Weston engaged in a criminal conspiracy to fix the price of bread, the most Les Mis-ass conspiracy you could possibly do as an evil billionaire, it finally got someone's attention, eh? Competition has a long way to go, but all over the world, competition law is seeing a massive revitalization. Sure, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher put antitrust law in a coma in the 1980s, but it is awake, it's back, and it's pissed. So what about regulation? How will we get tech companies to stop doing that one weird trick of adding with an app to their crimes and escaping enforcement? Well, here in the EU, they're starting to figure it out. This year, the Digital Markets Act and the Digital Services Act go into effect. And they let people who get screwed by tech companies go straight to the federal European court, bypassing the toothless watchdogs in Europe's many corporate crime havens. And in America, there's some move to finally get a digital privacy law. You people probably have no idea how backwards American privacy law is. The last time the US Congress passed a broadly applicable privacy law was in 1988. The Video Privacy Protection Act makes it a crime for video store clerks to share your rental history with the press. It was passed after a right-wing judge who was up for a Supreme Court seat had his rentals published in a DC newspaper. The rentals weren't even all that bad. They didn't embarrass him. It's true that Judge Robert Bork did not get confirmed to the Supreme Court, but that wasn't because of his videos. It was because he was a racist creep who couldn't shut up about it, and he was a Nixonite criminal who had been Nixon's Solicitor General and had done a bunch of bad stuff. But Congress got the idea that their video rental histories might end up in the newspaper, and they freaked out and passed the VPPA. And that was the last time America got a big national privacy law. 1988. It's been a minute. And the thing is, there are a lot of people who are angry about stuff that has some nexus with America's piss-poor privacy environment. If you're worried that Facebook made Grampy into a QAnon, or that Insta made your kid anorexic, or that TikTok is brainwashing millennials into quoting Osama bin Laden, or if you're worried that the cops are rolling up the identities of everyone in a Black Lives Matter demonstration or the January 6th riots by getting that data from Google, or that red state attorneys general are following teenagers to out-of-state abortion clinics, or that black people are being discriminated against by online lending or hiring platforms, or that someone is making gruesome AI deepfake pornography of you, then you want a privacy law. Having a federal privacy law with a private right of action, meaning that individuals would be empowered to sue even if a government enforcer wouldn't take up their case, will go a long way to rectifying all of those problems, which means that the coalition for that law is so large as to be unstoppable once it coheres. So what about self-help? When do we get back interoperability? Well, that's a lot further away, I'm afraid. It's true that the DMA will force interoperability standards on some of the big tech companies. You're going to be able to leave Facebook Messenger and still send them messages with iMessage and back and forth if you'd like. You'll be able to quit Facebook and go to Mastodon and send messages to the people who you left behind on Facebook. But if what the tech companies and the government agree to isn't enough for you, if you want to reverse engineer one of those apps and make it do something better for you at the expense of the company that made it, Europe has nothing for you in the DMA or the DSA. This is an area ripe for improvement, and I think it may be, given the direction of travel, that the US might be the first ones to open that up, which would certainly be on brand, right? For the EU to say, we have come up with the conduct that the tech companies must agree to, and for America to say, we've just decided we're not going to let you use the courts to stop other companies from doing stuff to you that you don't like. My big hope here is that Stein's law will take hold. That's a law from finance that says anything that can't go on forever will eventually stop. Letting companies decide how their customers must use their products is simply too tempting an invitation to mischief. HP has an entire building full of engineers thinking of new ways to lock your printer to its official ink cartridges, forcing you to spend $10,000 a gallon to print your boarding cards and shopping lists. It's offensive. And the only people who don't agree are the people running the monopolies in all the other industries, like the medtech monopolists who are locking their insulin pumps to their continuous glucose monitors in the hopes of turning people with diabetes into walking inkjet printers. Now, finally, there's labor. Here in Europe, there's a much higher union density than there is in the US, which American tech barons keep learning the hard way. There is nothing more satisfying in the daily news than the latest salvo by the Nordic unions against the Tesla guy. I have to say, Musk is the most Edison-ass Tesla guy we could have asked for. But even in the USA, there is a massive surge in tech union organizing. Tech workers are realizing that they aren't founders in waiting. The days of free massages and facial piercings and getting to wear black t-shirts to work that say things that your boss doesn't understand, they're coming to an end. In Seattle, Amazon's tech workers walked out with Amazon's warehouse workers because they're all workers. And the only reason those tech workers aren't monitored by AI that notifies their bosses if they visit the toilet during working hours is their rapidly dwindling bargaining power. The way things are going, Amazon programmers are also going to be peeing in a bottle next to their desk. You know, for a guy who built a penis-shaped rocket, Jeff Bezos really hates our kidneys. We are seeing bold, global, muscular action on competition, regulation, and labor with self-help bringing up the rear. It's not a moment too soon because the bad news is, enshittification is coming to every industry. If your product has a network computer in it, the people who made it can run the Darth Vader NBA playbook on it. They can change the rules from moment to moment, violate your rights, and say, it doesn't matter, we did it with an app. From Mercedes renting you the accelerator pedal in your car by the month, to the Internet of Things dishwashers that lock you into proprietary dish soap, enshittification is metastasizing into every corner of our lives. Software is not something that eats the world. Software is something that enshittifies the world. But there's a bright side to all of this, because if everyone is threatened by enshittification, then everyone has a stake in dis-enshittification. Just as with privacy law in the United States, the potential anti-enshittification coalition is massive, unstoppable. Now, the cynics among you might be skeptical that any of this is going to make a difference. After all, isn't enshittification just a dirty word for capitalism? It's not. Look, I'm not going to cape for capitalism here. I am no true believer in markets as the most efficient allocators of resources and arbiters of policy. If there was ever any doubt of this, capitalism's total failure to grapple with the urgent climate emergency surely erases it. But the capitalism of 20 years ago made a space for a wild and woolly internet, a space where people with disfavored views could find each other, offer mutual aid, and organize. And the capitalism of today has produced a global digital ghost mall filled with bot shit, crap gadgets from companies with consonant-heavy brand names, and cryptocurrency scams. The internet is not more important than the climate emergency. It's not more important than gender justice or racial justice or inequality or genocide. But the internet is the terrain on which we're going to fight those fights. Without a free, fair, and open internet, that fight is lost before it's joined. We can reverse the enshittification of the internet. We can halt the creeping enshittification of every digital device. We can build a better enshittification-resistant digital nervous system, one that is fit to coordinate the mass movements that we will need to fight fascism and genocide and save our planet and our species. Martin Luther King once said, "It may be true that the law can't make a man love me, but it can stop him from lynching me, and I think that's important. And it may be true that the law can't force corporate sociopaths in the boardroom to conceive of you as a human being entitled to dignity and fair treatment, and not just an ambulatory wallet, a source of gut bacteria for an immortal colony organism called a limited liability corporation. But it can make that executive fear you enough to treat you fairly and afford you dignity, even if he doesn't think you deserve it. I think that's important. Thank you."
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Sharealike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, Ryneck Studio at gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.